Thank you very much. So I would like to address the question of stellar explosions, and there's a connection to the question of gravitational waves, because as we're going to see, although stars are roughly spherical, they explode in a sideways manner. And having this aspherical or asymmetrical type of explosion, they are an interesting source of gravitational waves. I'm going to talk about massive stars. So those explosions are the outcome, or can be the outcome, of the life of a massive star. And we know that we need massive stars to make the black holes which have been detected, which coalescence has been detected. So those stellar explosions are possibly a promising source of gravitational waves which haven't been detected yet. So far, we have just detected the coalescence of black holes, but we hope in the future to be able to detect such explosions. So the picture here is the milestone supernova which exploded in 1987. So it's a milestone because it exploded at a time in 87 when we had on Earth powerful enough or sensitive enough detectors of neutrinos, and such explosions produce neutrinos which have been detected at that time. It was the first time and the last time. Although such supernova explosions take place every night in distant galaxies, those are too far to be able to detect such neutrinos. So we are very impatient to having such an explosion in our galaxy to be able to detect again neutrinos in more detail, because now our detectors are more advanced, and the very exciting perspective would be to detect it, to be able to detect it with gravitational waves, because having neutrino and gravitational waves is really a source of direct information from the very inner part of the star at the moment when it explodes. So I would like to say right from the beginning that understanding such explosions has been a challenge for many years, for 50 years. And this event was really the beginning of a robust theory of stellar explosion, but it's not clear whether we can call this theory robust yet, because our theoretical understanding leads to explosions with numerical simulations which are maybe a bit weakish compared to what is observed every night. So we can have a positive, an optimistic view on the state of theory of such explosions, and that's my view. But of course, there are many criticisms that can be raised. And so it's not only that we detected neutrinos for this particular supernova, but we also were able to identify the progenitor of the explosion. So by looking at photographic plates before the date of the explosion, the origin of this explosion was confirmed as the death of a massive star, which was a very important milestone to build a theory. And so for this difficult problem for theoretical astrophysics, I'm going to present a surprisingly simple fountain, just based on the flow of water along hyperbolic surface, which is going to teach us about the hydrodynamical instabilities which are responsible for asymmetric explosions. So I don't want to disappoint you with this fountain. So I don't want you to imagine that this fountain is going to explode in some way. So I'm going to show you from the beginning what you're going to see in this fountain, and little by little we'll see how interesting it is for astrophysics. So it's a fountain where you see this kind of rotating wave. You will see more details in a minute. But it's a fountain where you inject water from the outside towards the center. So here you have a very thin slit half a millimeter, where water is injected along this surface, and you produce, so there's a thin layer of water here, which is difficult to see. And then when the water meets this obstacle in the middle, this kind of vertical cylinder, it produces a shock, I mean the equivalent of a shock, which is called the hydraulic jump. And I will go into detail of this later on, but instead of having a perfectly circular hydraulic jump, which would have been expected since we inject water in a very stationary and axisymmetric manner, we see that some surprising dynamics takes place. And this is really from this type of dynamics that we are going to infer some interesting properties of stellar explosions. So it's quite, it's not an explosion itself. This is going to describe the moment when the star collapses, bounces, I mean the core of a star collapses to form a very dense object which we have heard of before, which is called a neutron star. So the core of a star is going to collapse to form a neutron star, and the matter is going to flow in free fall, is going to fall on this very dense center, and this flow of water is going to mimic the infall of the stellar core towards the center, and this cylinder in the middle is going to mimic the surface of the proto-neutron star. So this is the surface on which matter is crashing and producing a shock wave. So we are going to look at a very small region of space at the center of a star. This region is going to be like 300 kilometers in diameter. Out of, I mean, inside a star, which is several hundred million kilometers in radius. So we are going to look at the very, very small region, very small inner region, but which is the most interesting because it's the decisive moment for the success or the failure of the explosion and for the properties of this object in the middle, which is the neutron star. So the question that we are going to be able to address with this experiment can be summarized in this list of three. So this experiment should help us understand why a spherical star should explode sideways. It should help explain why a neutron star at birth is so fast, because this is an important property of neutron stars, is the fact that they are here is an example. It's the Guitar Nebula, where here you have a neutron star moving at more than 1,000 kilometers per second. So we will address this later. And also, what is responsible for the neutron star spin? Is it possible that a neutron star could rotate in a different direction than the rotation of the star from which it's born? So these are very exciting questions for astrophysics, especially given the simplicity of the fountain. But on the other hand, the simplicity of water motion in this fountain will be analyzed. I mean, the motion will be analyzed using very simple physical arguments that I guess you teach to your students, such that the question of scales in physics, or I mean, equations can describe things on big and small scale. The fountain is 1 million times smaller than the core of the star that it describes, and the equations are still similar. You have interesting analogies between, as I said, shock waves and hydraulic jumps. You have very simple energy arguments between potential, kinetic energy, and also thermal energy. And for these questions of the speed of neutron star and the spin of neutron stars, you have very simple arguments of conservation of linear momentum and angular momentum. The question of instability is probably the most advanced part of this list. But if you think of instabilities as simply the way that this stick cannot stand on its own and starts to fall, in a sense, you're going to see with this kind of fountain that the breaking of the spherical symmetry of the star is apparently a natural outcome of this simple experimental setup. And if you think of, for example, if you think of a flag in the wind, you are just used to see flapping flags in the wind. It's not so easy for you or me to explain why a flag should flap, because we could accept the fact that a regular wind would maintain the flag exactly along the wind. But there is some instability which we don't understand immediately, but we are used to see that so many times that we accept it. And in a sense, this fountain should make us used to accept the idea that a star should not explode in a spherical manner.
Can I just ask one thing? You had some kind of detector or weather vane hanging above the cylinder in that video.
Yes, I didn't say.
Can you repeat the question?
Yes, there is this metal bar. The question is about this metal bar here, which I will comment on later. This is just a passive piece of metal which touches the water, does not influence it, just to show the angular velocity in the inner regions and compare it to the outer regions. But we will go back to this later. So please feel free to interrupt any time, because this is meant to be really accessible. So now, I mean, I will try to make sense of this astrophysical sense of this fountain, but still we need to have a few numbers in mind, or in scales at least in mind. And there is this graph of time scales and length scales, which tries to summarize the diversity or the very wide range of length scale and time scales which you have to deal with when you study the death of massive stars. So I just put points in this diagram to show the typical size and time scale of several steps in the life of a star. So, for example, I put this point here on a time scale of 10 million years, which is going to be the duration of hydrogen burning at the center of a star, and then helium burning, carbon burning, oxygen burning, silicon burning are going to take place on smaller sizes. And also on shorter and shorter time scales, down to the production of an iron core at the center of this massive star, and at the same time as these regions of burning take place in the core of the star, you have the surface of the star shown by this line here, which has inflated at the moment of helium burning. You have now a red supergiant. So remember that each square is a factor 10, so it's really a huge scale here that you have on the logarithmic scale. And so what's important to show in this graph is that the region of interest in my talk is here at the lower corner, where time scales of the order of 1 second and the distance scales of the order of 100 kilometers are going to be important. But don't forget that between the scale of 100 kilometers and the surface of this red supergiant, you have six or seven orders of magnitude. And between the size, when the explosion starts in this very inner region, it takes some time for the shock wave to propagate to the surface, which we call the shock breakout. And then there are again seven order of magnitude to reach the size of known supernova remnant that we observe in the galaxy. So there is as many orders of magnitude inside the star as outside the star, in a sense. So this gives you an impression of how small this region is. And as the shock propagates and produces this supernova remnant, so it's a very important process in astrophysics, because it's going to feed the galaxy with new elements which have been synthesized inside the star. So it's the very important process uh, to to enrich the galaxy with heavy elements. At the same time, the core, which has been which has collapsed to a neutron star, so here on a scale of a few tens of kilometers, this neutron star is going to shrink to a little more than 10 kilometers as a pulsar, which is going to a neutron star or a pulsar, which is going to stay there for forever if nothing happens to it. So this is just a reminder of the different scales. Now, if we talk of those remnants, those famous remnants in our galaxy, it's a good moment maybe to make a distinction between two types of supernovae. Although when you look at remnants like those five at least, it looks like a sphere of ejected material which emits light in X-rays after hundreds of years. So we have seen pictures this morning by Lisa showed you the Crab Nebula with the pulsar at the center emitting in X-rays. There is this famous Cassiopeia, also very well observed, and the 1987A, which is much more recent, of course, very much smaller. So these three, this one is not strictly galactic because it's in the Large Magellanic Cloud. But these three prototype of core collapse supernova are the most popular, are the most studied. But and you have very you have beautiful supernova remnant, as the Tycho or Kepler or SN 1006, which are due to a different type of supernovae, which I'm sure you've heard of. Those are called thermonuclear supernovae. And they share some common properties with the death of massive stars, but they are completely different in a sense because they come from the collapse of a white dwarf. So the iron core, which I've just mentioned in the previous slide, has a structure, has reached an equilibrium, a balance between gravity and pressure. And it's a quantum pressure due to the degeneracy of electrons. And the same type of equilibrium is reached inside a white dwarf. So a white dwarf is about the size of the Earth, or the size of, I mean, a few thousand kilometers, but the mass of the Sun, typically, or fraction of the mass of the Sun, up to a threshold which is about 1.4 solar masses. And this threshold is common in these two types of supernovae, and those two types of supernovae are triggered for the same reason when the mass reaches or approaches this threshold. So either the iron core reaches the mass, this threshold of 1.4 solar masses at the center of a massive star, and starts to collapse because it's the maximum mass which can be supported by this type of pressure. And the same process takes place in if you have a white dwarf made of carbon and oxygen, which receives matter from a companion in a binary system, for example. And so the starting point is the same, but the story is after that is different, because in what we're going to describe with this fountain, this iron core is going to collapse and try to bounce and fail to bounce and lead to the instabilities I'm going to describe. And lead to a neutrino-powered explosion in the end. Whereas here, the main difference is that you're dealing with an object made of carbon and oxygen, which still has some binding some nuclear binding energy to feed the explosion. And so this is a thermonuclear explosion, because the fusion of carbon and oxygen into iron is able to give a huge amount of energy, which is able to completely explode this white dwarf and leave nothing behind. So there is nothing in the middle of these remnants. Whereas in those remnants, there is a collapsed core of neutrons, which is a neutron star, and maybe in some cases a black hole if this neutron star collapses. Okay, so this is an important distinction. Yes?
Why is ejection only up to silver? Why not any heavier elements?
Okay, so that's a very good question and very difficult one. So in the past, people used to think that supernovae would be responsible for all elements up to the heaviest, uranium, let's say. And so to maybe to answer this question, there is this you need to have in mind the how the binding energy is distributed across the elements, and so iron is this element with the highest binding energy, and so making these elements up to iron is a natural thing for a star if it's massive enough, whereas making all those elements beyond iron is not favored because all these elements would like to give energy by fission through fission reactions to produce elements close to iron. And so the way to produce those elements is through explosive reactions. When you have conditions to enrich nuclei with neutrons, so if you find conditions where you can throw neutrons to the nuclei, and then those neutrons will then produce protons, then it's a way to go along those heavier elements. But this is a out of equilibrium reaction, and so you need to find conditions in nature where you have a strong neutron-rich wind. And core collapse supernova is such a place where you have potentially a neutron-rich wind, but it's not as rich in neutrons as people thought 10 years ago. Detailed calculations show that actually this wind of neutrons at the moment of the explosion is not that rich in neutrons, and actually it's even proton-rich in some cases. So at the moment the favored place to go up to, so silver is here, to go up to uranium is the coalescing of two neutron stars, which happens to be the subject of, the search of gravitational waves from such mergers it happens to also be the favored place for heavy element production. And you can understand that two neutron stars merging, indeed, you have plenty of neutrons to build heavy elements. So the question then is, are there enough of those neutron star mergers to be responsible for all the heavy elements that we know in the galaxy? And the answer seems to be yes. But so the short answer is, in the supernova core collapse, there is no... The wind of neutrons is not rich enough in neutrons to go beyond this point. This is a very, this is work which such results may change over the next 5 or 10 years. Okay, so let me go back to this point. So now that we have clarified the difference between thermonuclear and core collapse supernovae, I just repeat what I said about these properties of neutron stars. So neutron stars are incredible objects. I mean, they are at least as interesting as black holes, because not only they have extreme gravity and general relativistic effects. I mean, not as large as black holes, but it's an object where you have general relativity, but you have also nuclear physics in a very very interesting environment. Matter inside a neutron star is really has neutrons really touching each other. There is very little space left inside a neutron star, and you have also electromagnetism, which, I mean, you have all theories of physics merged into an object. You have superfluids, superconductivity. You have all sorts of very complex processes in a neutron star. And one of the special properties of neutron stars is not only that they are very dense and it's the last stage before a black hole, but they are also very fast. So here is the velocity, distribution on a log scale. Here you have 100 kilometers per second, here 1,000, here. So typically you have 200 or 300 kilometers per second for those neutron stars, whereas normal stars from which they are born are typically 10 times slower. So this is a puzzle that you need to understand. It's actually one of the hints that the moment of their birth is not spherical, and that the asymmetrical nature of the explosion kicks them out at birth. And one other property of pulsars is that they are neutron stars. When we say the word pulsar, usually when they rotate, so they rotate quite fast. So I don't know if all of you are aware that such objects can rotate up to 700 times per second. I mean, theoretically, they can even rotate up to 900 or 1,000 times per second. So it's really the breakup velocity where the centrifugal force would balance gravity. So these are incredible numbers when you think that the sun rotates in 27 days or yes.
Is that
translational velocity? Yes. So this is translational velocity. The rotational velocity is when I say 700 times per second, it's some extreme pulsars which we believe are accelerated by a companion which provides some angular momentum. But at birth, the distribution of rotational periods is flat between 10 milliseconds and 100 milliseconds. So it's slower, but still,
How was this data collected? What's the method of estimating the velocity?
So there's a big population of maybe 500 or more pulsars, galactic pulsars, for which some astrometries. I mean, since it's so fast from year to year, you can detect the displacement. So usually it's a displacement in the plane of the sky. But I know there may be some other techniques. Maybe Lars could help me on this.
When they're out in the plane, they're born in the plane. So if you know their age, sometimes you can infer a high velocity from how far it is above the plane. Depends on
But this is really a reliable, statistically significant. It's a big population, and with reliable measures. Okay, so now that we know about supernova remnant, we know about pulsars, and we need to know a little more about the scenario of the explosion. So we have this a massive star. I took 15 solar mass as an example, 600 million kilometers, for example, as the outer radius. The core of iron is going to reach this threshold of 1.5 or 1.4 solar masses, and beyond this mass, the pressure forces are not sufficient to resist gravity, and it just takes half a second for this object, which is about the size of the moon, in half a second. It's so massive, I mean, it's more massive than the sun. It collapses in free fall to form a 50-kilometer proto-neutron star. And all the gas which was sitting on top of this iron core is falling in free fall and reaches velocities of 1/10 of the speed of light. You can compute that simply by measuring the free fall velocity given this mass and this typical distance. So imagine 1/10 of the speed of light, you have iron falling at 1/10 of, falling like it's raining iron at 1/10 of the speed of light, and you're supposed as a theoretician to find a mechanism to convince this rain of iron to change its direction and explode into a supernova. So that's the challenge that we face. And so we would like this to simply bounce and go back to higher altitude, but this doesn't take place like that, because there is a lot of energy lost in this bounds process. There are two very important losses. One is that by reaching such high temperatures, I mean, as iron crashes on the proton-neutron star, a lot of kinetic energy is transformed into heat. And heat is so large that it dissociates iron into protons, neutrons, and electrons. So the temperature is high enough to unbind the most tightly bound nucleus, which is iron. And so this is this costs a lot of energy. And then, unfortunately, those protons, neutrons, and electrons have a reaction which makes charged particles to disappear and have only neutral particles. So you have an electron captured on a proton produces a neutron and a neutrino. And so this is how you, little by little, you form this neutron star. At the beginning you had iron, here you had all sorts of particles, and now you have in the middle mainly neutrons. And all those neutrinos which are produced here, and all the neutrinos which are inside these proton-neutron stars, are able to escape apart this very inner region here inside the proton-neutron star, where the neutrinos take a fraction of a second to diffuse out. As soon as they reach this blue region, they are able to propagate and take away the energy of the collapse. So you had gravitational energy converted into kinetic energy. Here, kinetic energy is transformed into thermal energy. And here, thermal energy is taken away by a very efficient cooling reaction, is neutrino cooling. Neutrino take away this energy. So you had, at the beginning, enough energy to make a nice bounce. But at the end, all the energy is lost in neutrinos. I mean, 90% of the energy is lost in neutrinos.
Inside the neutron, the proto-neutron star, is the flux of neutrinos large enough to have them scatter off each other? I mean, is there neutrino-neutrino scattering?
Can you repeat the question?
The question is whether there are reactions of neutrino-neutrino scattering inside the proto-neutron star. So there are all sorts of reactions. I mean, on my side, I make simplified models, so I don't need to consider neutrino-neutrino scattering. But the people who develop advanced models, as I'm going to show on the next slide, really take care of taking into account all possible interactions. So I'm not able to tell you what's the importance of this neutrino-neutrino scattering. I wouldn't claim it's a big effect, but I don't have the slide here, but there's a very long list of all possible scattering reactions involving neutrinos, and I guess it's among them. Yeah. So, in this picture, it takes a fraction of a second for the neutrino to be absorbed, and the hope of this scenario is that, let's say 10% of those neutrinos are absorbed in this blue region, which is dense enough to still absorb a little bit, absorbed in this blue region, and deposit enough energy to heat up this blue region and push the shock into an explosion. So it's really some leftovers of the neutrino flux, which in principle should be enough to generate the explosion and power this shock up to the surface of the star. You have to remember that here we are so deep in the gravitational potential, remember 1/10 of the speed of light, that if you manage to get out of this very deep region, then propagating to the very shallow regions of the potential in the very external regions will be very easy. So the main difficulty is to get out of this deep potential well. So the most advanced numerical simulations by my colleagues in Germany look like that in 3D. So these are a huge computational cost, where you see in yellow the accretion shock of the matter falling towards the center. So in black, it's not empty. You have matter flowing towards the center. This is the accretion shock, which is now showing some bubbling activity. And on top of this bubbling activity, you have this large scale sideways motion of the shock. And at the center, you have this white sphere, which is the surface of the protoneutron star. So the, what you've just seen here lasts about 300 milliseconds. So each large scale oscillation which you see is about 30 milliseconds. And this is in diameter. Here it's about 300 kilometers. So we are still dealing with this very, very small region. So, and all the difficulty here is to convince this this shock to start moving outward. So what you saw here is how important the deviations from spherical symmetry are. And there are two types. So those two types of deviations are due to two instabilities. One is familiar to most of you, I guess to everybody. It's simply convection. So you have here you have a view of the accretion shock during the phase we saw in the movie. And you have bubbles of material which have absorbed enough neutrinos to be hotter. So those bubbles try to rise against gravity in the same way as hot air would try to rise against gravity. So this is just it's called neutrino-driven convection. So those are bubbles heated up by neutrinos. And on top of this small-scale motion, you have a large-scale motion, which was not familiar to anyone on Earth before it was discovered in these simulations. And it's called the standing accretion shock instability. It's responsible for large-scale displacement of the shock. And luckily, it's this unfamiliar phenomenon which is taking place in this fountain which we're going to look at. So I'm not going to go into detail, but I explained that those convective motions are due to buoyancy. It's natural convection. Whereas here, it's some interaction. The mechanism of this standing accretion shock instability is due to the interaction of acoustic waves and vortices. So acoustic waves are able to generate vortices as they reach the shock. Vortices are able to make to produce some sound as they are traveling towards the neutron star. So it's called the advective acoustic mechanism. It's not familiar in astrophysics, but it was familiar to people drinking tea. Because when you look at the whistle of a kettle, you have this cylinder here, which is represented here. So actually you have two rings at the entrance and the exit of this cylinder. And as the gas, as the water vapor flows across this cylinder, it generates a shear layer of vortices. And as these vortices have to pass through the exit ring, it's not easy for a vortex to go across this ring. So it generates some pressure feedback and going outwards and inwards. And the pressure feedback going inwards is going to trigger the formation of new vortices with a phase relation setting the frequency of those vortices. So this is this kind of instability is responsible for the whistle which you hear in the kettle. So here you have an example of coupling between acoustic perturbations and vorticity perturbations. And this is well known by the people who study the vibrations in the engine of rockets like Ariane 5. Where you have a similar problem of coupling between a vorticity and acoustic wave, which is responsible for a kind of low frequency vibration, which you want to avoid. And also people studying rockets are familiar with a similar process involving not, this time it's not vortices, but it's entropy blobs. You can imagine fuel which is not properly burnt will travel down the nozzle, and as it passes through the nozzle, it also generates some feedback, feedback loop between acoustic waves and the entropy perturbation. So this is, from the point of view of physics, this had been studied in detail, but it had never been considered in astrophysics. And now let's now translate all of this into the water fountain. So the water fountain is based on this analogy between hydraulic jumps and shock waves. So the here you have, I guess you recognize what's happening when you pour water in a kitchen sink. You have this transition between a shallow layer and a deeper layer, which makes this beautiful circle in your kitchen sink. And this transition is really the analog of a shock wave. It's a point where the flow is trying to decelerate. So at this point, the flow was faster than the waves. It's the equivalent of being supersonic. Supersonic is faster than the speed of sound. Here, you're faster than the speed of the surface gravity waves. And to decelerate to subsonic velocity, the equivalent of subsonic velocity, you cannot do that in a smooth manner. You always do that through a discontinuity. And this is what your kitchen sink is telling you. You need to listen to your kitchen sink. And so if you now think of the collapse to the black hole, to the neutron star, you want to reverse this this kind of flow. So you inject water from the outside towards the center at a supersonic velocity, in the sense faster than the waves, and then you generate this this discontinuity, which is the equivalent of an accretion shock. And here it's what you would have expected if this accretion shock was stable. So it's just the beginning of the experiment. And to mimic the neutron star, as I said at the beginning, you have this cylinder in the middle, which is an obstacle to the flow of water. And since you cannot neutronize water to let it settle on the surface of this cylinder, you just get rid of water by letting it spill over the edge of this hollow cylinder. So you have this analogy between. Even a mathematical analogy between the propagation of acoustic waves in a gas, and surface gravity waves in shallow water. So any change of density and pressure in a gas is going to be represented here as a change in surface on the height of the free surface, so the change of depth. So this is the most encouraging part for students, for your students, is the fact that this fountain was built with very simple tools in May 2010 in my garden. So I just wanted to try having this inflow of water. So the difficulty was to have a uniform injection of water. So I started with a few pipes, and then more of them, and then in a few months I had this design of a injection slit, which you saw at the beginning, and the results were so resembling the results of astrophysical simulations that this experiment made the cover of Physical Review Letters in 2012. After, of course, comparing its results to numerical simulations in a careful manner, because when you do experiments, as you know, sometimes you get artifacts or. Yeah. So here we checked things carefully. And then my institute in France, CEA, built for me a new experiment, with much better quality than this one, which was used by the Science Museum in Paris to teach astrophysics to the public. And they also built another experiment, which I'm going to show you now, which is a bit more advanced because it's able to rotate and incorporate the angular momentum of the collapsing star. And I should say that we are now building another one which is now 3.50 meters in diameter with my colleague Gilles Durand, and to have a bigger scale, so smaller effects of viscosity. So when you look at it from the top, this is the development of the instability in the experiment, and this is the development of the instability in a gas simulation, an astrophysics gas simulation, where you see you start from an oscillation and then you develop this rotating motion. And this is a simulation of the experiment. So this is the simulation of water. And so you see that the simulation of the experiment confirms that what's happening in the experiment is what is expected from those equations, and the resemblance between the different simulations is striking. So now if you look at the first movie which I showed you, now I start really from the beginning. So I inject water. You see that first there are bubbles in water. So now you see this very thin layer containing bubbles. And at the beginning, the hydraulic jump is more or less circular. It's a little bit turbulent. There is this object in the middle, which is just here to follow to track the velocity of the inner regions. And you'll see that as a flag, this hydraulic jump doesn't manage to stay steady. So it starts oscillating. And as it reaches nonlinear amplitudes, I mean larger amplitudes, it's going to switch to a rotating motion in some random direction. So here it's going to rotate to the right. And you're going to see that as it rotates to the right, the inner regions of the flow rotate in the opposite direction. And this is really the consequence of conservation of angular momentum. Since there was no angular momentum in the flow, in the incoming flow, if you have created some rotating motion somewhere, you must have created the opposite motion somewhere else. So here you have first illustration of the fact that you can spin up a neutron star from a star which was not rotating at all. A non-rotating star can give birth to a rotating neutron star. Now, if the fountain rotates, so you see a very slow motion of the fountain at the outer edge here, you can demonstrate, it's not a trivial thing, but you can demonstrate that the instability is going to always rotate in the same direction as the fountain. So this oscillation of the hydraulic jump is preferentially transforming into a rotating motion in the same direction as the fountain. And the inner region of the flow, which initially rotated in the same direction as the injected flow, are now trying to resist the rotation of the hydraulic jump, exactly for the same reason as before, because there is now more angular momentum contained in this hydraulic jump. So the opposite angular momentum is falling towards the center, and now it's this rotating motion has to resist against the incoming accretion flow. But for this particular rotation rate, you see that through a kind of stochastic motion, this inner region of the flow is able to resist the rotation of the progenitor. Yes.
Real quick, the inflow of water matches the outflow, so they're not accumulating
any. Yeah. Problems. No. Because this boundary condition at the center. Is a kind of self-regulatory. It will always allow water to flow out. So here you have an illustration of the fact that a rotating star can give birth to a counter-rotating pulsar, which is quite non-intuitive, but it's a simple illustration. And now, of course, if you have a device which is able to rotate, you like to see it rotating faster. And this was a big surprise, because when you rotate it faster, so here you see the rotation rate here is faster, clearly, you discover a new instability which was not at all expected. So it's one of the benefits of this experimental approach is that it revealed an instability which had been found in some numerical simulations and which is actually important for gravitational waves, because this instability follows a different mechanism related to differential rotation. The fact that you have strong shear motion, the inner region rotate much faster to first order, angular momentum is conserved. So when you inject water with a certain rotation rate, it spins up like 1 over r squared, simply due to the conservation of angular momentum. And then on top of this very differentially rotating flow, there is this spiral arm which develops and which redistributes the angular momentum. And this, in the interior of a differentially rotating neutron star, so I'm talking of an isolated neutron star here, if you have such a differential rotation, this instability is very efficient at emitting gravitational waves. And so here it's a slightly different context because we are accreting matter from the outside, but still this instability is able to develop. And of course you want to see faster rotation. So if you rotate faster, you don't even need a neutron star in the middle. So it's accretion on a black hole here. And the centrifugal force is enough to produce a shock. You don't need an obstacle. So the centrifugal force itself is enough to produce a shock. And this shock is, again, unstable to some large-scale deformation, which try to redistribute angular momentum. So this one, I show you this just for the sake of curiosity. But it's quite amazing that this simple experiment with water shows this range of dynamical behavior. So I'm going to finish by showing you the connection to gravitational waves before my conclusion slide. So when you have such asymmetric motion inside the very dense and very massive regions, we are talking of the vicinity of the neutron star, you can measure, so some people have estimated the kind of gravitational waves which should be detected. And you saw the complexity of various instabilities. I have simplified the problem here. I have not talked about this convective buoyancy-related motion. So you have different phases. You also have a phase of prompt convection, which can be inside the neutron star. You have this Sassy instability. And after the explosion, you have also, depending on the shape of the explosion, you have a signal which can go up or down, depending of the whether the shape of the explosion is prolate or oblate. So it's more complex than binary black holes. But still, people hope, by comparing the gravitational waves for different types of, for example, here, different type of equation of state, because there are some uncertainties about the nature of the equation of state of dense matter inside the neutron star. You could have preferentially this, for example, this signal would be the signature of the Sassy instability for a soft equation of state, while a stiffer equation of state would not show this kind of instability. Whereas this line here, in both cases, is the excitation of gravity modes inside the neutron star. So I don't want to go into the details of those this complexity, because at the moment people try to establish reliable signatures that people in LIGO will be able to recognize if such event takes place in the galaxy. We have to know that those amplitudes are so small that only if a supernova explodes inside our galaxy that we will be able to detect them.
Yeah. Is there any relationship between the direction of the rotation and the rotation and what happens in our atmosphere, cyclones?
Yeah, so here the time scale of this experiment, as you saw, is about 3 seconds. So it's a very short time scale in the experiment, whereas the Earth rotation is 24 hours. So the effect is really negligible for this particular experiment. For cyclones, the motion of clouds is on much slower timescales than 3 seconds, so that's why it can be influenced by the Earth rotation. But for such process, it's no, it doesn't. I mean, I tried to see if there was a preference, but I mean, the experiment is influenced by many other effects, which are much more much stronger than Earth rotation. Okay, so I leave you with my conclusions. I hope I would like to summarize the fact that having a non-axisymmetric, I mean, having a non-uniform distribution of matter around the neutron star, when you have a region here which can absorb more neutrinos than when you had circular distribution. So this will help the explosion, having one region which is able to absorb more neutrinos, and this can be a trigger for a neutrino-driven explosion. So this explains why such instabilities are favorable to solve the mystery of supernova explosions. But having this asymmetric distribution is also a natural explanation for the kick of pulsars, because as matter is ejected in this direction by linear momentum conservation, the pulsar is going to be kicked in the opposite direction. And also for the spin, we mentioned the conservation of angular momentum, which implies some spin properties of the neutron star. I'll take your questions now.
Let's thank Thierry first. So before the shuttle leaves at 5:30, we have time for questions. Raise your hand and I'll come over with the microphone. Ah, okay, there's some back there. Oh, you got it.
Yes, you mentioned that the neutron star could be rotating in a different direction than the parent. Have these been observed? Or direct observations or only simulation?
So there is a binary system of neutron stars where indeed one neutron star rotates along an axis which is like this compared to the other, so it's opposite and also not aligned. I don't claim that this is the only explanation for that, but yeah, it exists. Yeah.
In the fountain simulation, how important is the viscosity of the water, and is there an analog to the iron core that would relate to that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So the viscosity of water is indeed stronger than what you would like, but it's strong. The strong effect of the viscosity of water is ahead of the hydraulic jump, is in this region, which is very shallow. And so you have a viscous drag. The main effect of viscosity is a viscous drag, which slows down the flow ahead of the... But since the dynamics of the instability is ruled by the deeper region, it's not a problem. But we take into account, when we compare this to numerical models, we take into account a viscous drag here, without free parameters. So we just take a laminar viscous drag, which doesn't involve a free parameter. And then you have the transition to turbulence. You notice that the flow can be turbulent. And this, in the Reynolds number associated to this turbulence happens to be comparable to the expected Reynolds number in the stellar case due to neutrinos. Neutrinos are responsible for a diffusion of linear momentum, the carry linear momentum, and in the vicinity of the neutron star there is a Reynolds number of the order of 1,000, which happens to be by chance comparable to the one we have in this particular experiment. But this is true only very close to the neutron star, and the neutrino effects in this region shouldn't be as strong. So I don't claim that this is a I would prefer to have a larger experiment with less viscous effects. But the good thing with the numerical simulations is that you can really estimate in the numerical simulation of the experiment, you can switch off the viscosity of water, you can choose whatever you like, and then you can estimate whether this is a strong effect or not, and usually it's not a very strong effect.
I've got the next question, I guess. It's really great to hear the specifics of what happens with, you know, white dwarf star that's accreting material and then the details of exactly what occurs. But I don't hear much about what happens if a neutron star is a binary companion and is siphoning material and it exceeds like three solar masses. Does it supernova into a black hole? I don't really hear.
No. If the neutron star exceeds the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff limit, so which
what does that mean?
There is a limit. I said there is a limit for white dwarfs or for the iron core due to the degeneracy pressure of the relativistic electrons. This is 1.4 solar masses. But there is another limit for a group of neutrons resisting gravity through the strong interaction between neutrons. There is a limit due to general relativity, which is somewhere between two and three solar masses. We don't know exactly. And at this point, the neutron star collapses to a black hole, and this is not expected to produce. No, not no. Yeah, I have never seen any effect, any external effect. Usually, it's just it's for me. It's like in my experiment, if I suddenly push down the cylinder, so there is no longer a hard surface, then everything will be absorbed in the middle. So this is the intuition I get from this experiment, and I have and from numerical simulations, I have never seen any. It does not exclude that some complex effect of particle physics would lead to something more complex than this was our experiment, but I don't know of such example.
Hold on a second.
Two quick questions. One, on a neutron star, you talked about it having an electric current or conductivity, which to me meant moving charges, but
yes, they are
neutral.
Charges, yeah.
That was one, if you could address that. And then and now I can't find what my other one was.
There was a neutron star is dominantly made of neutrons, but there is still a fraction of electrons. So you have a magnetosphere around pulsars and a very strong, this is also one of the amazing thing of those objects. You have pulsars which have 10 to the 12 Gauss magnetic fields, and then you have magnetars which have 10 to the 14 Gauss magnetic fields. These are considered to be the engine of superluminous supernovae. So you have a whole range of exotic phenomena associated to the strength of the magnetic fields of neutron stars or magnetars. But yeah, there are charges. As I said, the interior can be superfluid, can be superconductive. So it's very, very, very rich laboratory for physics.
Yeah. So the matter in a neutron star should be called neutron rich, rather than
neutron
purely
rich.
Neutrons,
yeah.
Because presumably there's an electron gas and a proton gas.
Yeah, but I think it's neutron very rich.
Very rich. Okay, another question.
Sorry, I thought of the other question.
Yeah, you know, here, we have plenty of time.
We understood why there was a frequency for rotating black holes or neutron stars. Where are you getting the frequency from
The frequency for?
For
the instability?
This.
Yeah.
Not the instability, but the frequency of the gravity wave.
Yeah. So the frequency of the gravity wave would be twice the frequency of the of the pattern you see. And the frequency of the pattern of the rotation here, or the oscillation, is more or less defined by the advection time, how much time it takes for matter to go from the shock to the neutron star. This is what sets, I talked about this cycle between vortices and acoustic feedback. The acoustic feedback is fast, vortices are traveling at the speed of the flow. So the dominant time scale is really the travel time of the flow from the shock to the neutron star. And this is about 30 milliseconds. Yeah.
Question over here.
I'm just curious as to what made you think of your garden hose experiment, because, you know, my students aren't, I'm trying to encourage them to be more creative.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
like the spur of science. So what drew you to say, I'm going to yes. see if water
And it's a very important point for me, on which I always insist when I show this to the public. People should, maybe I didn't say that the cost of this experiment was very affordable. I mean, these five different experiments in total cost €1,000. So it was something I could afford. So what made me think of it is that from the textbooks, you learn that waves in water, in shallow water, behave as acoustic waves. And actually my work before this experiment had focused on trying to understand why we should expect or not this, what was the mechanism. So this this coupling between this little drawing here was really the work which took me a lot of time. And once I understood that there was nothing more than those ingredients, there is nothing more than acoustic waves and a shock and vorticity perturbations to explain this unstable dynamics, then it was clear to me that it was not specifically astrophysical and that I could reproduce this on Earth. And actually, I immediately thought of engines in rockets involving shocks, and contacted some friends who were working in this field and learned that indeed they had the kind of instability which I showed here, and having those simple ingredients and the textbook showing that you can mimic this with water, I was led to try it.
I have a question. It's often said that a mountain on a neutron star, a mountain would be about a centimeter high on a neutron star, would also be a source of gravitational waves. Yeah. Would this funny pattern help create mountains on the surface of a neutron star?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I showed at the end the gravitational wave signature, this thing and even this line. I mean, here you have the Sazi instability, but this instability also contributes to feed. When I said I briefly said, oh, this line is gravity. Modes of the neutron star. But what is a gravity mode? A gravity mode is a deformation of the full structure of the neutron star, which in a sense produces mountains on a large scale. So it's not a small scale mountain. It's more distributed deformation, but it's really the same type of mm-hmm. Of processes.
No, I understand that. I have my question was a little different. Imagine an actual mountain on a neutron star, 1 centimeter high, let's say, or whatever a mountain height is. Wouldn't that interact with this other asymmetric, just the way you tidally lock?
Yeah, of course, but then you have to explain why, where the mountain comes from in
well,
the first place.
It may have originally come from this instability, but wouldn't this be a self-sustaining, wouldn't the mountain get bigger?
No,
because of this funny asymmetric pattern. No,
I mean I think you need to explain first why is the mountain here, there.
Yeah.
If it's maintained by some process, then maybe the process will get.
Well, I'm imagining the accretion also has the same asymmetry that you're showing.
Yeah.
But that's not the case.
No, and also one big difference with the mountain and the neutron star is here we are dealing with a neutron star which is very hot. Mm-hmm. Which is so hot that it can be 50 kilometers in diameter,
yes.
and then slowly shrink to 10, and so it doesn't have a crust like a neutron star, mm-hmm. where you could imagine maybe the mountain that you have in mind. It's more like a fluid.
So this is a proto neutron star.
It's a proto neutron star,
which is different than a neutron
yeah,
star.
Exactly.
Yes, sure.
Exactly.
Other questions? Yeah, one back.
Yes, you mentioned that the formation of elements heavier than silver is from colliding neutron stars. And so if you look at our own solar nebula to form our own solar system, what is suggested to have happened in order to get the composition? How many colliding neutron stars or other types of supernova were needed to generate the 2% heavy elements that we needed for our, you know, for us.
I don't know the number, but it's the, so I don't know how many such coalescences were necessary, but what I know is that the mixing by differential rotation in the galaxy is so is efficient enough to get a uniform abundance of heavy elements, but I don't know the number of events.
Okay, more questions. We have time. Yes, Duncan.
I have a quick response to that question. I was discussing exactly this.
Ah, very good.
So Chris Belchinski, who chaired the last session, this is an active topic of research. So placing constraints on the neutron star merger rate from the abundance of our process elements. And the binary neutron star rate in our galaxy is one every 10 to the 5 years, right? So the rate of these neutron stars colliding in our galaxy is not high, but our galaxy is very old, so enough of these we think have collided to explain the our process elements. The platinum and gold, these heavy elements have to be formed in these neutron-rich environments. But if you can find Chris Belchinski, if he's still around, he's just written a paper on this.
So you said 10 per million years?
Yeah.
And one galactic rotation is 200 million years? So that's the number is big.
Other questions?
Just a naive follow-up, but all right, so you form these heavy elements. How do they leave the neutron star to go out into outer space and
yeah, because actually, when I was talking of this neutron-rich wind, actually, when you have a coalescing neutron stars, you have tidal streams. You have a lot of matter ejected from the coalescence. So, at the same time as the neutron star meet, you have tides on the other side, which let a lot of material flow out. This is one thing, but also neutron stars are known, the coalescing neutron stars are known to be a source of short gamma ray bursts. So while you have this motion with tides in the orbital plane, you have also some ejection of matter along the axis of this orbital plane. And also in these jets, which give, which produce the short gamma ray bursts, also maybe there may be some R process. I'm not sure about where the R process is preferentially taking place, but the geometry is not 2D, but really 3D.
More questions? Yeah, hold on.
So if you think, but if you think of neutron stars are being one of the most interesting objects in the universe, then coalescing neutron stars as a source of R process, I mean heavy elements, and as a source of gamma ray bursts are really, really interesting.
Yes, go ahead.
Are images or videos of the fountain available for those of us who don't have access?
The videos? Everything will be recorded here, and some of the videos are already on the web. Not all of them, but if you ask me, I can give them to you.
What would we Google to find the videos on the web?
You type supernova fountain.
Supernova fountain.
My name. Probably okay. So supernova fountain.
Okay, that's great. More questions. I have a question about the rotating experiment. What is rotating there? Is it the drain also, or is it just the outer jets?
It's everything. It's the full experiment. The full experiment is rotating.
So the whole table.
So there is some entrainment. You could mm-hmm. think that there is some entrainment by this surface,
mm-hmm.
but that's very negligible because as soon as the water mm-hmm. enters, as I said, the angular velocity increases like 1/r².
Yes.
So the angular velocity of water is much faster than the entrainment. Actually, the fountain slows down the flow rather than entraining it, except at the outer edge, where the angular velocity of the water coincides with the velocity of the fountain.
Is that equivalent? What if I only rotated the drain apparatus?
Like the drain, you mean this
yeah,
part?
Just that cylinder, I rotated something.
No. It wouldn't do anything because this cylinder is...
Wouldn't you have no slip on that cylinder?
I mean, at the outer edge of the cylinder, but you have an incoming flow, so this would not propagate against the flow.
Okay, yeah, a question over here. Hold on, wait for the microphone. Wait. Okay, go ahead.
The water is going radially towards the drain?
Yes. So now with this slow rotation, there is a small angular component. The answer is no. When the fountain rotates, in addition to the radial component, there is a V theta scaling like 1 over R to conserve angular momentum. So omega like 1 over R squared.
And if you, suppose you had superfluid and did the same thing.
That's what I wanted to do that at the beginning. But if you do that, you lose all the simplicity of the experiment. But I wanted to get rid of viscosity because the astrophysical fluid, I mean, apart from this viscous neutrino viscosity, which I mentioned, astrophysical fluids are usually inviscid in a good approximation. And so I thought that, and I thought it would be good, but if you want to make a superfluid experiment, then you need to make a small experiment, so otherwise it's too expensive, so you have to cool it down. You lose all the beauty of all the simplicity of the problem. But I'd like to see the result, of course. I know some people have studied the kitchen sink hydraulic jump using a superfluid. They did that at in Paris, actually, at the École Normale Supérieure. And they were a bit disappointed because they could not obtain a uniformly superfluid flow. So you had a superfluid on top, but you had at the bottom, you still had a moderately viscous flow. So yeah, doing this is not an easy task, apparently.
Yes.
Does the size of the drain affect this?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Very good remark. Actually, the strength of this instability depends crucially on the ratio of the shock radius, or hydraulic jump radius, divided by the drain radius. So yeah, there is a geometric factor which, when I said that advected vorticity generates some acoustic feedback, when I explained the mechanism, the amount of feedback that you generate depends how much you have squeezed the size of the vortex. So the larger the ratio of those two scales, the stronger the instability. And this is true for the fountain. This is true for the astrophysical simulation. This is a very important parameter. If you want to have a stronger instability, either you shrink the neutron star because it's a shrinking neutron star, which was 50 kilometers in radius and shrinking to 10. So you can shrink it faster, or you need to have an accretion shock which is initially larger.
Some geologists or geophysicists, they use a rheolytic liquid. Have you tried that?
Yes, I have. Yeah, this is one of the first things I wanted to do when I...
What's a rheolytic liquid? I don't think we know what that is in general.
It looks like you have silver particles inside of
of
the liquid.
Got it.
And,
yep.
And as it changes density, you can see
great
changes.
Okay.
But it's the particles are elongated,
yes.
So they orient themselves along the flow lines, and there are some... sometimes those are used in shampoo, so it makes some. You have some beautiful
yes.
Flow lines in the shampoo, but you see this in science museums. They use this a lot to show turbulence, for example. And I used it, and I was very disappointed because those particles highlighted all the small-scale features of the flow, although I wanted to highlight the large-scale instability, and they drew the attention to, for example, this. You see that the hydraulic jump here is a kind of double line here. You have the outer edge, and then because it's a kind of roller, a horizontal roller. And so a lot of this fluid will be captured in this second line here. So the result was disappointing. And then it was a mess to clean up the...
Okay, I think we should end the session and end the conference. Thanks everyone for coming. And
okay.
Thanks to Thierry and all the other speakers. So I hope you come again next year. Thanks for your feedback. We'll let you know which date we're going to choose for the 2018 Teachers Conference. Have a good trip back.